Sometimes I like to be obstreperous. That's just, I like to do that sometimes.
Sometimes he likes to be some.
Hey everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
She's back. I'm back. We're back.
We're back.
We're back. It's been like a long time.
We're just hanging out.
Time. It's been a long time.
I know,
time.
It kind of has actually. I heard your voice and I was like, that's not right.
What?
What's going on
no.
here?
No. This, of course, is Make Me Smart, the show that connects the dots on all things tech, economics, and culture.
And today, please believe me when I say, we really mean this. None of us is as smart as all of us because, and frankly, I'm shocked that this doesn't happen more often. We had a conversation planned for you today and it fell through because our amazing expert guest couldn't make it for reasons outside anyone's control. Yep. We were not stood up. So we're going to reschedule.
I think it's interesting. I just felt the need to say that.
I do. Like, I don't want anybody blaming anybody. There's no blame here. These things happen in life. And so in the meantime, in the parlance of my friends here in Silicon Valley, we're going to pivot.
We are. We totally are because we're flexible and, you know, agile and all that stuff. So what we had done actually this week already, even without today's show falling through the floor, as it were, we had gone out to the Marketplace staff, to the newsroom, and asked them what they wanted to get smart about. We were crowdsourcing, if you will, and we got a whole bunch of really great suggestions. So we are going to do a couple of them, starting with one that's actually on the news, believe it or don't.
My name is Stephanie Hughes. I'm a producer for Marketplace Tech. And my question is, why do we have a debt ceiling in this country?
Stephanie.
It reminds me of a curfew that we never seem to make. It just seems like it causes so many problems and we have to sort of raise it each time. And I just don't know why it exists.
I know her. Okay, I'm just saying I already love Staff Show. I'm like delighted to hear all the peeps we know. Hi, Steph. And to help us with that one, actually, we got Kimberly Adams, no big, we just pulled her off deadline because it's kind of a big news day in the budget department.
She's getting more time on this podcast than I am lately. Holy cow.
She really is.
Don't get jealous, guys.
I'm not saying it's part of our plan.
But
I'm only saying,
plan.
Oh, welcome back, Kimberly.
Yes.
It's been so long. Molly.
My goodness gracious me.
We're probably not going to talk about space.
We'll talk about the budget.
We're not.
You're on deadline too, right? So we got to kind of boogie with this thing?
Just a little bit.
All right, good. So there's a whole bunch of questions wrapped up with the debt ceiling, but give us the like 45 seconds of history of why we even have the freaking thing.
Because people thought it would make Congress look bad to keep voting to spend more money.
Oh!
When we all know Congress can make itself look bad.
It wasn't quite 45 seconds, but...
Is it literally that? It's just like budgets make people feel good and then it didn't work? Aww.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a debt ceiling in various versions and permutations since like, well, we've had a country, really. But mainly the model that we kind of look at now in terms of a debt limit kind of started kicking in the early 20th century. And then it just got higher and higher and higher. It used to be that Congress had to approve one by one every single like time that they wanted to issue new bonds to bring in more money. And then later on, they sort of bundled it all together and said, okay, let's just put a cap on how much money the Treasury can borrow at any given point in time. And that cap keeps going up and up and up as we keep spending it. And that is why we have the debt ceiling arguments that we have today. And even though we've never like fully defaulted on the debt, as in not fully chosen not to pay our bills, there have been a couple of instances where, say, it went right up into the last minute and then due to some technical glitches, Treasury paid a bunch of folks late, or Treasury has had to use what they call extraordinary measures and move money around because they passed the threshold. Or there was, I think when I was looking at this today, there was one incident where like the Air Force couldn't pay all of its bills for a particular point in time because they didn't raise the debt limit in time.
Damn Air Force, says the Navy guy. So this is timely. Come on. You know, all these years later, I still carry the inter-service rivalry. This is in the news, obviously, because there is a budget deal between the White House and Nancy Pelosi. We're still waiting to see if Republicans in the House of Representatives will sign on to it. The debt limit now has been lifted for 2 years. We have a budget deal. That gets rid of, and I know I'm going a little off here and I know you're busy, but we're going to get rid of something called the sequester. And I want you to help explain that and contextualize it in terms of how we spend money in this country.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Please.
So, I mean, back to the debt ceiling first, though, you notice that extension of the debt limit is just long enough to get us past the presidential election.
Shocking.
Because nobody wants to deal with that right before an election. So that's worth keeping in mind. Sequester. So this all comes from something called the Budget Control Act of 2011, which was part of this big fight between President Obama and the Republicans over the debt, over the deficit and spending and all these things. They came to a deal that said, look, we're going to put these spending caps in place and raise the debt limit at that time because they needed to do it. And if we don't hit these spend, if we try to surpass these spending caps or we can't come to a deal to stay under them, there's just going to be ugly across the board cuts for everyone, like defense, non-defense, children's programs, like all everything except for a few things that were exempted, things like Social Security, Medicare, veterans services and things like that. So anyway, that happened. And that's what we call the sequester. But it's so painful that it very rarely, like, meaningfully happened. So basically, they put in these caps. There was a, you had the sequester threat. And ever since then, really after a couple of years of existence, Congress has just sort of ignored it, these budget caps.
and we are actually now spending more money, right? The ignorance of the budget cap, the thing about ignoring the budget caps is not only did they ignore them, but they authorized more, but they appropriated more money.
Yeah, funny how that worked.
Right.
Fiscal restraint seemed to be something that everybody liked to talk about up to a point. If you remember, when the Tea Party Republicans swept in 2012, a lot of them were talking about we need to have fiscal restraint. We need to spend less money. We need to do more to slow down government spending and debt and deficit. And now you don't really hear anybody talking about that because who wants to have their programs in their districts cut? And so, you know, I don't know. It's one of these things where Congress has basically passed laws over and over again to say, yeah, because we're trying to avoid these painful cuts, we're going to agree to this deal that allows us to spend more. And hopefully it'll just be dealt with at some point down the road.
I just have one thing I want to clarify, which is that when the House Speaker and Senate Minority Leader released, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer released this joint statement, they said they were pleased with the deal and they said they were glad the administration, quote, has finally agreed to join Democrats in ending these devastating cuts. These devastating cuts refers to the sequester.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So the Budget Control Act was going to naturally expire in 2021. And so here's where we get into some real Washington wonkiness. The last time they maneuvered around these cuts, these budget caps, was in 2018. And in the 2018 deal, to avoid the sequester, they said, OK, we're going to, you know, let us spend more money than we are allowed to up until, I guess, what was it, 2020, I think it was a 2-year deal. And so that's what they were trying to avoid. So when you see all these numbers about, oh, this is allows us to spend X amount of millions of dollars over the spending caps, well, that wasn't what we were actually spending. One of the economists that I was talking to today was saying this actually kind of keeps spending more or less where it was. It's just if you compare it to what the spending would have been under the budget caps, which we were supposed to revert to because the 2018 bill expired, that's where you see this big jump.
Which is
Did
where,
that make any sense?
No, it makes total sense. But look, here's where I'm going to climb in, Mollywood, and ask you to cast your mind back to the beginning of this year or maybe the end of last year when we had our prediction show. And my prediction was nothing is going to change.
Nothing's going to change.
I'm just saying. Thank you. I don't even know what that sound effect was because I like it.
I thought that was a pass to Tony, but I guess it's you were right.
That's a Kai was right tone right there. All right, Kimberly
Kai
Adams, we will let you get back
you get to hear that.
Never. I never get to hear that. we'll let you get back to work for the
Kimberly
show this
Adams,
afternoon.
Thank
Kimberly,
you.
Thanks.
No problem.
Oh, man. Yeah. Nothing
amazing.
Changes.
I don't know how she keeps that all in her brain, but that was amazing.
Great. So here's the number, by the way, and I like to read this out loud because it's so bananas. As of last Friday, according to the U.S. Department of the Treasury, our total public debt outstanding is $22,023,119,533,123.43.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and correct you there because I'm at usdebtclock.org,
yeah,
which we will have on our website. And it actually says that we're at 22,525,460,000.
Could totally be. This is last Friday's number. It's
no,
totally
no,
true.
We went to 461. Anyway, you can go here and watch this in real time. I wouldn't encourage it because it's a lot of blinking numbers and it gives you kind of a headache, and also it does incur an almost immediate sense of hopelessness and despair because you're looking at this number going like, okay, what is the point of
any of this?
Like,
who is meaningless?
It is. Yes, it is that. It seems to be so big as to be meaningless. Good times.
All right. Another story in the news earlier this week about your money and your data this time. Our acquisitions editor, Eve Epstein, had this to say.
My question is, how much of that $700 million settlement that Equifax reached this week will actually go to rebates for people who were harmed by the data breach? And how likely is it that everyone who was harmed will file or jump through the hoops they need to file for that money and that will all be spent? Thanks.
Yeah.
It's a lot of hoops, by the way.
I will say, if you jump through the hoops, you can, in a little tiny way, stick it to Equifax because the estimates are that if everybody went through the hoops and claimed what they are owed, that it would essentially cost Equifax $16 million more on top of the $650 or $700 million that they're going to have to pay
already.
$16
billion more, right?
Just million.
Oh, all right.
You get to stick it to them in a tiny way.
Yeah.
Almost half of the settlement will go toward American consumers. It's a little unclear the form, though, that that is going to take. And likely it's either one of those things where you get like $80.
Right.
If you're lucky, because it's a class action thing. I think some of it would be dispersed in the form of credit monitoring.
Right. Right.
So it will include some cash compensation, some credit monitoring, and then help with identity restoration. I think we can assume that the bulk of what you as the consumer will see are services that will benefit you, that by the way, you should remember to cancel, otherwise you'll get charged for them again the future. $125 million has been allocated specifically to cash compensation.
So this was a biggie, right? The biggest, or certainly one of the biggest hacks of consumer data in this economy. It will not be the last, right? So what are we
There were like 30
to,
more in between then
yeah,
and now.
Sure. So what are we to do? And that's kind of a serious question.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I've been talking to a lot of security professionals lately who say that we really have taken this kind of like blame the victim approach. Like, we should all change our passwords and enable two-factor authentication and make sure that we're not the weakest link. Goodbye. But somebody always will be. Like, someone will continue to be the weakest link. And the fact is that I think we're having a conversation that doesn't seem to go anywhere about whether fines are enough for companies. And sure, $700 million, $650 million is a lot. Equifax has paid no real price other than this outlay. Like, nothing about the way they operate has changed. They're getting away with a settlement that allows them to provide their own services or pay its competitor, Experian, to provide services. That is not, I don't think that anybody, you know, much in the way that you have had to consistently ask, why didn't anybody go to jail in the financial crisis? I don't think anybody feels like these are real remedies to what's happening or that they are a real look at the business model of our data.
So at the risk of sending you off on a deep, deep tangent, we are expected to get tomorrow. This is Tuesday. This news is supposed to come tomorrow. Confirmation from the Federal Trade Commission of their $5 billion settlement with Facebook over Cambridge Analytica and all of that. $5 billion, as we know, is like pocket change for Mark Zuckerberg and for that company in particular. Will that change behavior? Will anybody be incentivized to take better care of our data? What say you, Ms. Wood?
I mean, it would take a lot of $5 billion fines to really make a dent. And yes, I think, and in fact, producer Stephanie Hughes, who we heard from earlier, is fond of saying, like, look, it's a lot of money. And companies will pay attention to a $5 billion fine, unquestionably. They'd already set aside $3 billion. So the fact that Facebook's stock went up
right
when reports of this settlement broke. Tells you all you need to know right about what this means in terms of an existential threat to the business model. Like, the business model has not changed. It sounds like the FTC could not agree on mandating any kinds of changes to the way that the company operates. And yeah, it just doesn't, much like Jesse Eisner, his book, The Chicken Bleep Club.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to say the brown word because I don't want to get us that E.
The brown word. what are you, five?
But it's all about... It's all, you don't call it the brown word at your house?
No, we actually say the word at my house.
Well, it passes the 9-year-old test and it doesn't get us that E, although I think we should go for the E. Anyway, that was the tangent you were really afraid of. That book is all about how, over time, the U.S. Justice Department right has stopped really pursuing serious measures against companies and has settled in terms of fines. And we have right seen what that has done in terms of corporate self-governance, right?
Right.
Like, Boeing alone tells us that this model is not working. So no,
yes,
nothing about this fine, nothing about the Equifax fine, nothing about the Facebook fine, none of that is going to have a meaningful difference in the way right they operate their business.
Jesse Eisinger, by the way, is his name.
Eisinger, thank
the
you.
The chicken.
I was going to say Eisenberg. Club, it's so close to the social network guy, ironically.
Yeah, well, that's what I was thinking, yeah. All right. Another one, what do we got?
Okay, what's next?
Hey, Kai and Molly, this is Heron, one of the editors in the newsroom, and my question is related to something that seems to be exploding all around in our health and beauty aisles in Los Angeles, and that is CBD-infused products. There are CBD face creams, oil droppers, some are for anxiety, some are for sleep, and my question is, what is CBD versus THC, and what is hemp or hemp seed? I just want to understand what these compounds supposedly do and where the regulation stands, because it's obviously big business.
And I think it would not be unfair for me to paraphrase here, what on earth?
Yeah, what on earth? Don't want to say the
what on earth?
Yeah, I don't know. Although I will tell you, anecdotally, we have a colleague who I think tried some CBD topical product, right? Mm-hmm. And this colleague is, her name appears at the end of this broadcast, the very, very end of this broadcast, the very, very end of this podcast, if you're looking for a name. She said it was hocus pocus. It was just nothing.
Oh, well, I'm gonna go ahead and tell you that I recommended the oil to her.
Oh, that's so funny. And? That is so funny.
I have been using the oil because I had a neck thing going on. And I will say, from my perspective at least, I sleep like a baby. However, I'm an awesome sleeper. So it's sort of hard to say which one. But
So let's do the regression analysis. Take awesome sleeper out of that.
Well, it's basically like if you gave, you know, a pro athlete steroids, they'd be better at being a pro athlete. I'm a good sleeper.
Right,
and
right,
then I took
right,
this like right relaxation sleep aid thing and I was like, wow, I slept 11 hours. I feel awesome.
Right.
So two things. One, the claims around what CBD can do are vague at
yep
best. It is fair to point out here that for years, the federal government has prevented the Centers for Disease Control and other government organizations from conducting research on the medical benefits of marijuana and CBD.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the reasons that none of these claims have been confirmed
right
is because the studies were forbidden and have not yet occurred. So we do have to wait to see what the deal is there. There are scientists, according to the New York Times, who are legitimately excited about CBD. There is a lot of legitimate research now ongoing. The laws are kind of all over the place. Like, if you look up whether you can take it on a plane, it's sort of like sometimes you can and sometimes you can't. CBD, we did our whole episode on cannabinoids. And
yeah,
CBD is supposed to not contain any of the compound THC that
right
makes you high. It's
right
apparently, I learned at the dispensary when I went and bought the oil for my neck. Evidently, it's impossible to fully separate the compounds. So that's might be why you get a little relaxed. Like, I noticed that I can't use the oil during the day because after a little while, and I'm very sensitive.
Is that what we're calling it now?
A little relaxed. I noticed that if I try to take it during the day, that after about an hour, I get a little just like mushy mouth, which obviously is not good for work. I've only tried it on a Saturday. Look, I'm just trying to help. I'm trying to make you smart. God.
No, look, I am learning things. I did not know, actually, that it was tough to get all those, separate all those elements. And I did not know that.
But what
that
I think
happened.
Is really interesting. So it is crazy mainstream. Like, it's showing up in,
yeah, for
you
sure.
know,
for
coffee.
Sure.
Like,
look,
every...
there was a report that they were going to put it in Coca-Cola, which they're not, by the way. The CEO denied that yesterday. But,
right.
But yeah.
But they might. Apparently, pro athletes, like the NBA and the NFL in particular, are having this huge conversation because all the athletes want to use CBD. They're like, look, it would really help us. It would help with inflammation. Because what they think specifically is that CBD can really help with inflammation. And inflammation as a syndrome is the thing that causes all kinds of things from, you know, muscle pain to like lupus.
Right, right, right. So here's what we need. We need a listener out there or several who are actually trained in this kind of pharmacology to send us some information and their thoughts. And we'll put you on the pod. How about that? Do we think that'd
totally
be a good
will.
Idea?
We're looking to you to be an expert.
Yes. There you go.
But it's a huge, if nothing else, is big money.
Yeah, for
big
sure.
money.
For sure.
Totally. I have a friend actually who works in packaged products. She used to work at a large company that makes granola bar type snacks.
Yeah.
And now works at a different snack company, is looking for a job. And she says that there is not a job in Northern California in packaged goods right now that does not involve CBD. And she's like, it's a real problem for me because I have this really like traditional mom and I can't tell her that I work with CBD. But that's what I mean, for packaged goods in particular right now, it's just like, it's the only thing going. A lot of money.
All right. Send us a voice memo. Make me smart at marketplace.org if you are knowledgeable about this kind of thing. There we go. And then we're coming back. But first, we're going to have a break.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
Sometimes Kai's a little cantankerous.
Sometimes I get a little obstreperous. Oh, there we go. We're back.
Look at
we're
that. Back. Hello.
Hello.
Oh, hi.
Through all
we're
of
back.
Our
it's been it has been a while.
Oh, you
since
just
we got
put
to do...
that in there.
What? No, it's been
you
in there the whole
cheater
day.
Cheater butt. Oh my God.
Been in there the whole time.
Fine.
I
go
think,
ahead.
I think Kai almost called me a brown word.
Right. Well, I think butt doesn't get you the E.
It's in the category. It's in the family. Of
anyway,
the one we're talking about.
Upon what I are did, you fixated this week?
I did. I just put it in and I apologize.
Thank you.
I am weirdly fixated on this otherwise kind of boring sounding story about Apple potentially buying the modem chip
otherwise
business.
Otherwise boring sounding? Sell this one,
Intel.
Baby. Go ahead. Yeah, so Apple's going to buy a chip business from Intel. Discuss.
Apple is going to buy the smartphone chip business from Intel, which is fascinating because, again, Intel just like... I'm trying so hard not to say, like, pooped the bed. Intel blew it in mobile, legendarily.
And thus the theme
for like,
the broadcast
it's like Inception. I know. We have incepted. So Intel sort of blew it in the mobile business. Apple is becoming increasingly legendary for producing all of the parts of its phone, right, for this sort of vertical integration that includes the software. There has been speculation for a while that if Apple really wants to make a 5G phone and not be totally reliant on whatever Qualcomm does, that they're going to have to make their own chips. And they have been, but apparently now feel like if they're going to really leap ahead to 5G, that they need to acquire Intel's business, get to work, like separate themselves from Qualcomm. But what I think is interesting is that they're locking in even more vertical integration at this exact moment in time in the conversation around big tech. Like, I think at this point, one of the only things they don't manufacture are the displays, which, fun fact, Samsung makes. So we're about to find out whether, like, that's a problem, right? That they're just... Because there had been speculation that Apple's chips, the chips it already makes, are good enough that it could spin off its own chip business. And then now it's going to buy it and make its own 5G chips and just, like, own every part of the supply chain. And I don't know if that's a problem for them or not, but we're also going to start to find out real soon whether 5G sells phones.
Well, so I was just going to say, you mentioned there that, you know, they're doing this to leap ahead, as you said, into 5G. First of all, I thought 5G was it, right? There's no leaping ahead. You got to be there or you're going to be left behind, right? Are you not saying that that's what's what?
Well, I'm sort of saying, like, nobody's actually there. Like, it seems like everybody is at 5G, but they're really not. Qualcomm, you know, was set back a little bit by its failed NXT acquisition. And, I'm getting so nerdy right now.
No, that's fine. I'm gonna rescue you from yourself.
Yeah, thanks.
And just to be clear here, 5G, so there's 5G for phones, which we're talking about, which will be zippy and fast. But the underlying thesis of 5G is that it's so zippy and fast that Internet of Things is going to work, that your refrigerator is going to be able to tell you when you need milk, right?
Yeah, it's that you can, yes. It is so zippy and fast, but also that so many devices can connect to it simultaneously. Right. And then the idea about even 5G on phones is that if you look at like what 4G did for phones, which was allow an entirely new economy built experience, on always on fast connections, that 5G will take that and make it, you know, you'll have like VR on phones or augmented reality. Yeah. Now, I have this whole budding other theory kind of related to this that like Apple's too late anyway because phones are about to go away and all computing is about to become ambient. But that might be like down the road.
What?
we don't need to be looking at these little hoodickies anymore. Like it's just like it's hurting our necks. It makes no sense.
So is it going to be a chip in my brain? Is it what do you mean ambient?
No, it's going to be in the fridge. It's going to be in the fridge, or it's going to be in the smart speaker.
Yeah,
it's
but
gonna
if
be
I'm
in the
walking
walls,
from
it's
my,
going to be in the car.
If I'm walking from my car into the parking lot at Marketplace into the building, and this is going to sound ridiculous on the face of it, right? But I've got 35 seconds to kill on that walk. I'm going to want to be able to pull my phone out of my pocket and check my Twitter feed. I don't want to wait till my desk pops up and shows me something on a hologram on the wall.
You're going to have you'll have either a little ear thing, like an earbud, or you will have augmented reality glasses.
Okay, when?
15 years? There's some joke that technologists always say 15 years because like it's unprovable. Yeah, definitely 15 years.
All right. Okay, my turn. Much more pedestrian, much more, much lighter, as it were. Certainly not as deep thinking. So as we all know, Robert Mueller is going to Capitol Hill tomorrow, testifying. Big, big deal. Lots of coverage. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is a line in the New York Times profile of Mr. Mueller the other day. Straight arrow, clean marine, government G-man, likes to, you know, go straight to the hearing, doesn't want to engage in small talk with anybody. And then it says, and this is in the New York Times, Mr. Mueller, an early riser, was known among close FBI aides to be fond of Starbucks pumpkin spice lattes. I'm out. He's dead to me.
I literally caught on to that at the last possible minute. And I was like, oh, my God, he's going straight for the pumpkin spice.
Robert Mueller's dead to me. A lifetime of service to his country, and I don't care. That's it.
I'm
out.
Did I also see on Twitter that the pumpkin spice latte is already coming
There are things already there. People are tweeting pumpkin spice things at me now, and it's summertime.
No.
Don't get me started. I guess I already guessed that. Anyway, all right, that's it.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right.
Last week, while Kai was away, perhaps you heard, I co-hosted Make Me Smart with Kimberly Adams. Maybe you knew that we fulfilled our years-long dream of hosting a space podcast together, and it was the best.
It was amazing.
It was the best. All about the space economy. And actually, I'm about to sneak in a second news fix, but I'm very excited that did you hear about the light sail? Light sail too, like solar sailing through space, like this idea that you can travel through space powered by solar wind.
Do we have one? I've heard about that, but do we have one now?
We do. It's going, it's a CubeSat, and it was launched last month on the SpaceX Falcon Heavy, the Planetary Society's Light Sail 2.
Oh.
Solar sailing spacecraft. It's rolling around right now.
Light Sail 2.
I'll send you guys the link. I'm very excited about it.
That's
nutty. I think I kicked in like $25 to their Kickstarter like 7 years ago.
Do you get anything?
And I get
that?
The.
What do you get?
I mean, I get the newsletter. Worth it.
We have a newsletter too. Anyway,
Steve, it's been a good ROI over the 7 years. Steve Gammon kicks us off, actually, though, in your comments with a stargazing listener comment.
When I was a kid, my parents would take us camping, and we would all lay around and stare up at the sky and say, "Oh, there's a shooting star." And now, when I take my kids out camping in the dark field, I say, "Oh, there's a satellite."
Yeah, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's funny.
And it's only going to get worse.
Going to get more crowded, right? And when you think about, you know, so when did Sputnik go up? 1957-ish, right? So it's only been like 60 years, and there's all kinds of stuff flying around up there. Anyway.
Yeah, in fact, this week, we covered the problem of the SpaceX satellites, which we did mention on our, Kimberly and I mentioned on that space show, the idea that thousands of these little satellites are going up to provide us with internet access in space, and mm-hmm. a lot of them are pretty visible. And there's a Amazon Echo explainer on how satellites are becoming more and more
nicely
popular,
done.
Which will continue nicely to affect done. Hiking and camping. Like, it's going to, especially with Jeff Bezos trying to move all our industrial operations to space, like, you're going to be able to see that.
Jeff Bezos. All right. Sandra Weber from Kirkland, Washington, said she enjoyed the space episode for a couple of reasons. Here you go. The space industry brought us so many things we take for granted, she said, like computers and duct tape and Tyvek. I don't even know what that is. It deserves economic respect. I enjoyed learning it's the size of the beverage industry, which I'm just going to take for, you know, granted is big.
$400 billion a year.
Wow.
Or $1 billion. $400 billion. Yeah. We were like, what else is $400 billion? Wow. Economic respect.
Yeah, no, it's true.
Should be like it's a true. T-shirt. Okay, anyway. Due to the changes in the programming that we mentioned at the top of the show, there is no answer to the Make Me Smart question this week. But of course, we always want you to ponder what you might say. That question again, what is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about?
Also, I mentioned this earlier real quick, we've got a newsletter, Get You Smart, throughout the entire week. It's actually really, really good. I say actually like I'm surprised. I'm not. It's really, really good. You can subscribe to it, and please do, marketplace.org/newsletters.
Make Me Smart is produced by Shira Morris. Our senior producer is Eve Tro. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Thanks to our video producers, Ben Hethcote and Summer Dunsmore, and of course to Kimberly Adams for jumping in on deadline
no
at
joke.
The last minuto.
Superstar she is. This week's program is Superstar she is. This week's program was engineered by Ben Tolliday. Our theme music was composed by Ben and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
I'm just saying that was a little bit of a half-hearted Yoda. Like, if you're going to do it.
Well, look, I was on the fly here, man.
Do or do not.
Try? I was you know? On.
Come
there
on.
There is no try.
Right? Jesus. Give a guy a break.
Do or do not, Yoda. You can't just, like, bust out your Yoda at the drop of a hat. What kind of nerd are you?
Oh, man. I'm not actually.
It's Comic-Con
big,
week, man.
I know. Speaking of. Oh, we didn't even talk about Marvel in Phase 4 and what a travesty that is because Disney is just sucking money out of people with continuing. Never mind.
Let me just say that I could not agree more, and I think Abigail Disney is with you on that as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I am an avowed giant freaking nerd.
I know.
And I read that list of movies that are coming out, and I was like, no, no, no.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A future episode, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Disney. Right. However, I will subscribe the crap out of that
of course
streaming service.
Yes, of course.
I will give them all my money. Because it has FX. That's where all my crappy movies are.
All right. Gotta go.
I can't win. I can't quit you, Disney.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.